Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Join the millions of players around the world and bring in the new year with the all-time favorite classic match three game, Candy Crush Saga. It's fun to play and challenging to master, with thousands of levels to switch and match your way through. Get that sweet feeling this new year with Candy Crush Saga. Download it now from the App Store or Google Play for free.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Valerie Sanderson, and in the early hours of Wednesday, the 1st of January, these are our main stories. Australia has seen in the new year with wildfires raging across huge swathes of countryside. Thousands of people have had to seek refuge on a beach as flames encroached on a seaside resort in the state of Victoria. The United States is to send more troops to protect its embassy in Baghdad, where there's been an attack by thousands of Iraqi militiamen. Also in this podcast, the former head of Renault-Nissan, Carlos Ghosn, has fled justice in Japan for freedom in Lebanon, to the delight of some.
People were looking at him as someone iconic, people who lost hope, found hope in him.
So it's another year in Australia, but the wildfires which raged across much of the countryside at the end of 2019 are continuing with no sign of abating. Thousands of people have had to seek refuge on a beach as flames encroached on a seaside resort in the state of Victoria. As we record this podcast, there have been 12 deaths, with a father and son the latest victims, and the fires have wreaked widespread devastation on wildlife and destroyed more than 900 homes in the state of New South Wales alone. Our correspondent Shama Khalil spent the day in Balmoral Village, one of the worst-hit areas of the state. She spoke to Rosemary Doyle, a widow who lived opposite the fire station with her late husband for 13 years. Her house was razed to the ground when fire ravaged the village.
Watch your feet. So, Rosie, would that have been your garden or your veranda?
These three steps lead up to the veranda and the back door. I had French doors approximately here going into the dining room, and French doors going into that room there.
Jesus. When the fire struck the village, you had to hide in the fire station just opposite here. Tell me what that was like.
I can say the most traumatic experience of my life. When smoke was coming in, we were evacuated further back into the back area. Yeah, just looking across and seeing two children in there distressed me. And then wearing masks and smoke still coming in. One of the lovely fireys got up and asked if people wanted to pray and pray together. I just felt, no, I don't want to die here. I don't want to die today. Not like this.
What was it like stepping out and looking across the road and seeing your house burn?
Yeah, I just couldn't believe it. And
what did it look like?
Just fire coming out of every window in the house, and just all I could see was red, completely red, and then just room by room going.
When you're looking at something like this, at your house burning down, what was going through your mind?
The only thing that was going through my mind at the time was that I had left my husband's ashes in the house, and
So his ashes were in that space where the twisted corrugated iron is now?
The corrugated iron has been moved so that I could get in there, and I later went back with the urn that was donated to me and collected as many ashes I could. They may not all be his ashes, they may be ashes of the house, but and that's probably quite fitting as well.
How does it feel to be standing here looking at it now?
I guess just surreal. I mean, I'm looking at it and I guess I can see all the damage. I can see it's been absolutely flattened. And I still in my head, though, I can still recognise where every room is.
You mentioned that even after the destruction and the kind of the fire raging through the village and burning down your house, you still like to come back here. Why?
Because it's home. And feel some stability, to feel safe. You feel safe at home.
Shaima Khalil speaking to Rosemary Doyle in Australia. The Pentagon has announced it's sending reinforcements to Baghdad in response to this. That's the sound of troops firing tear gas into a crowd of protesters who'd breached the outer edges of the US embassy compound in the Iraqi capital, starting fires and smashing windows. They were supporters of the Iran-backed Iraqi militia Kataib Hezbollah, whose bases were attacked by US missiles at the weekend, causing the death of 25 fighters. That, say the Americans, was payback for an earlier attack by the militia, which killed a US contractor. So, what exactly happened? Maya Gabelli is the correspondent in Baghdad for the French news agency Agence France-Presse.
There was a funeral procession that was planned to mourn the deaths of the 25 fighters that were killed over the weekend in U.S. airstrikes. And this funeral procession marched to the Green Zone. And normally this Green Zone is actually under, you know, very high security. This march that was organized today was able basically just to sail through those checkpoints and were able to reach the U.S. embassy relatively easily. Once there, they set fire to U.S. flags, they scribbled graffiti on the walls of the embassy, and they were actually able to breach the first wall of the U.S. embassy, which is unprecedented. I mean, no one's been able to get that close in years until they actually reached that first wall of the embassy. At that point, U.S. security forces that are based inside the embassy were calling out over megaphones for protesters to back away. Those calls went ignored by the protesters, who threw rocks at U.S. security forces that were there, who wrenched the security cameras off of the U.S. embassy walls, and then drew pro-Iran slogans all over the U.S. embassy walls.
Maya Gabelli of AFP in Baghdad. For an American reaction to the events in Baghdad, we turn to the former U.S. Assistant Secretary of State, retired Brigadier General Mark Kimmett.
We have always trusted the government of Iraq to protect all the embassies, all the foreign delegations. It's a responsibility every country has around the world to protect foreign embassies. If the ministry had grave concerns about this, then we would have expected to see some sort of additional security. Yet in this case, they simply let the people into the international zone without any stopping them of any kind at all. I believe there was a belief that these protesters would protest peacefully in front of the embassy. And by the time they got there, we found otherwise.
Was that a miscalculation or was it something more sinister then?
Well, it's clear after the fact that the Iranian-backed militias inside the country were going to use this opportunity for some retribution against the American attack against the bases the other day. I don't think anybody anticipated the ferocity or the level of violence that we've seen with this. But there should have been enough of a concern that there should have been forces on standby in case this situation went topsy, which it did.
What do you think of the Iraqi government's response so far?
Well, I'm quite disappointed. In fact, I've been disappointed in the Iraqi government for quite some time. We have warned the Iraqi government many, many times that these rocket attacks that had been going over our bases and over our embassy for some time would meet a strong response if any killed American citizens, which is what happened.
Do you believe that the Iraqi government is an effective ally for the United States at the moment?
I think the government of Iraq is weak. I think the government of Iraq recognizes that the vast majority of people inside of Iraq do not want to be under Iranian domination. This situation today probably brought that to a head. And given the choice between a government that is strong and sovereign versus a government that's under the control of Tehran, I think this is a wake-up call for that government that they need to take the appropriate actions, not only against the Shiite militias that are attacking the embassy, but also the protesters who have been in Tahrir Square since October 1st. They've got to make a decision. As I said, are they going to be a government for the people of Iraq, or are they going to be a proxy government for Tehran?
For America, this is an incredibly important front now, isn't it, in the battle against Iran. So is the fact that this has been allowed to happen in any way a failure of American diplomacy?
Well, I think it could well be considered a failure of all the coalition forces and coalition nations that are participating inside the operation. But let's be clear, we have a president that rightly or wrongly believes that we are involved too much in the Middle East. And he may use this as an opportunity to say, well, listen, despite the blood and treasure we've given to the country of Iraq, if they don't want to stand on their own 2 feet, then we're just going to pull out. Iraq has to want it more than we do. And if they don't, we'll find another front and another location to do it.
Former U.S. Assistant Secretary of State Mark Kimmett speaking there to the BBC's James Kumarasamy. It is all the hallmarks of a spy thriller. The details have been emerging of the flight of former Renault-Nissan boss Carlos Ghosn from house imprisonment in Japan to freedom in Lebanon. Our correspondent in Beirut, Quentin Somerville, has been following the story.
When the Japanese courts allowed Carlos Ghosn out of prison on bail, he disguised himself as a construction worker to slip past journalists. His escape from Japan may have been far more elaborate. He arrived in Lebanon on board a private jet from Istanbul and entered the country legally using a French passport and his Lebanese ID card, according to the government here. But all three of Mr. Ghosn's passports, he has French, Brazilian and Lebanese citizenship, are with his lawyers in Tokyo. Lebanon says it has no idea how he left Japan. But Arab news channels, including Al Arabiya, say they know. It reported he was smuggled out, hidden in the instrument case of a Gregorian band who had performed at his home. The 65-year-old former chairman of Nissan is 5.5 feet tall. A private security firm used former special forces operatives to orchestrate the plot, see local media. Although born in Brazil, Carlos Ghosn is of Lebanese heritage and is one of the country's favourite sons. The Lebanese Foreign Ministry said Beirut did not have an extradition agreement with Tokyo, but was keen to maintain good relations with Japan, a major financial donor. But Carlos Ghosn is well connected politically. He's also featured on one of the country's postage stamps. Now he's here, Lebanon won't give him up easily.
Quentin Somerville. Ricardo Karam is a Lebanese television presenter and a friend of Carlos Ghosn.
People were looking at him as someone iconic to whom they can identify themselves and who can nurture a vision and a willpower to do better and to reach a pinnacle of success and high positions. People who lost hope found hope in him. The way things happened and the modality, how he's been arrested, how he's been treated, how he's been imprisoned, people who were maybe against him became with him after having seen a human being deprived from his human rights and from a freedom of saying out loudly what he can say, having the lawyers he can have, seeing his family members, and being imprisoned.
The Lebanese TV presenter, Ricardo Karam. You're listening to the Global News Podcast on the BBC World Service. Still to come.
The most recent supernova that was visible to the naked eye was in 1987. That was 100,000 light years away. And so although that was spectacular, it was nothing like this.
Could one of the brightest stars in the sky be about to explode? The woman often described as Africa's richest woman, Isabel dos Santos, is in the spotlight after judges in Angola ordered the seizure of her assets and bank accounts in connection with an investigation into a billion-dollar corruption inquiry. Ms. dos Santos is the daughter of the country's former president, Eduardo dos Santos. She's reacted furiously to the ruling. Our Africa editor, Will Ross, told me what the judges had said.
It was a very public announcement on state television, and they basically said that Isabel dos Santos, along with her husband and the chairman of an Angolan bank, had caused the Angolan state to lose over $1 billion. And that included an alleged attempt to smuggle $10 million into Russia. Now, the court documents talked about vast sums of foreign currency being moved to companies abroad, And then it said in a bid to recover all this money, Isabel dos Santos's assets had been frozen in Angola. That's her personal bank accounts, as well as her very substantial shareholdings in some of the country's biggest companies. She has a 25% stake in Angola's main mobile company, as well as a significant Banco de Fomento Angola. So, assets frozen by the court.
And she's responded quickly, hasn't she?
She has. So a lengthy statement has come from Isabel dos Santos, basically condemning this as a politically motivated attack, which she says is not lawful. She says the trial went ahead in secrecy. She didn't have any lawyers present. She talks about all the companies that she's created in Angola, employing over 10,000 people. She says they're all at risk now, and actually she described them as being like a death sentence for those companies. But she said she's going to fight this in international courts as well as local courts.
And tell us about the dynasty she comes from, because it is an extraordinary family, isn't it?
It is. So Eduardo dos Santos was president for 38 years. And throughout that time, corruption was at an extraordinary level in Angola. The gulf between the poor and the rich grew ever wider. Of course, there was a lengthy civil war going on as well. But yes, the whole family has, since the president stepped down 2 years ago, the whole family's really come under a lot of pressure. So the man who was handpicked to take over from Eduardo dos Santos, President João Lourenço, he was you know, very keen to make anti-corruption his big drive, but nobody expected him to go after the first family, as it were. And it's not only Isabel dos Santos, it's also the former president's son, who was in court earlier this month, accused of helping transfer $500 million from the sovereign wealth fund that he headed.
Will Ross. Triple talaq is the practice of instant divorce, which allows Muslim men to divorce their wives legally by saying or texting the word talaq, that is repudiate, in Arabic three times. Since July, it's been a criminal offence to end a marriage in this way in India. Prachi Pingley reports from Mumbai.
After 2 years of trying, the government has finally succeeded in converting the triple talaq criminalisation ordinance into a law. This is a big victory for the government.
Lauded by most of the Indian media as a progressive measure when it was passed in September, criminalisation of triple talaq means that any man who proclaims instant divorce just by uttering the words talaq, talaq, talaq can be prosecuted and jailed for up to 3 years. Speaking in Parliament, India's Law Minister Ravi Shankar Prasad said the new law will protect all married Muslim women.
It's important to understand that one of the core philosophies of the Indian Constitution is gender justice, equality for women, and this is what we are promoting.
But the wheels of justice are turning slowly for 31-year-old Jannat as she soothes her 9-month-old son and hands him over to her mother as we sit down to talk at her lawyer's office. Jannat is the first Indian Muslim woman to file a case against her husband under the new law, which allows for retrospective action.
He would always threaten me with divorce. Any problems that we had, he would say that he would leave me. So one day he called and said talaq three times on the phone and said that he didn't want to be with me anymore.
Her husband pronounced talaq on the phone and WhatsApp in November 2018 after they had yet another fight in their troubled marriage. Jannat was in the third trimester of her pregnancy at the time. But life has become much harder for Jannat after she filed her case. Her local community has criticized her. They accuse her of going against Islam. After 4 visits to various courts, she is frustrated by the lack of progress.
I'm not bothered about my future. But what will I say to my son about his father? I worry about these things, about the social stigma. And the courts are taking forever. It's such a struggle.
Despite the challenges and difficulties, She's aware of the impact the verdict in her case will have on the lives and struggles of other women. Jannat is a reluctant trailblazer, but a determined one.
When you get a sense of things going wrong, don't give them a chance to say talak three times and leave. If you can't stop it, then make sure you fight for justice in the courts.
Jannat, ending that report by Prachi Pingley. Astronomers say one of the brightest stars in the night sky has started to act strangely, prompting speculation it could be about to explode. The huge star, Betelgeuse, is the dimmest it's been in a century, and astronomers are now training their telescopes on the heavens to work out exactly what's happening. Our science correspondent, Rebecca Morell, has been taking a look.
Betelgeuse is usually one of the most dazzling stars in the Orion constellation. But over the last few weeks, it's been fading fast, and some stargazers are wondering whether it could be on the brink of death. The star is what's known as a red supergiant. It's about 700 times wider than our sun, but has a short lifespan because it's burning through its fuel so quickly. If this dimming did mark the end for Betelgeuse, it would die in a spectacular supernova explosion. And for a few months, the star would outshine all others at night and would even be visible during the day. Dr. Robert Massey is from the Royal Astronomical Society.
The most recent supernova that was visible to the naked eye was in 1987. That was 100,000 light years away in a neighbouring galaxy to our own. So although that was spectacular, it was nothing like this. So it would give us the chance to point telescopes at it, to see the expanding material, to see that at really high resolution. And I have no doubt whatsoever that if that did happen, there would be an absolute armada of telescopes pointed at it.
Because of the star's distance from the Earth, its detonation could have already happened in space. It takes about 600 years for the light to reach us. But many astronomers think Betelgeuse may be around for a while longer, and that the changes in brightness are just part of the star's natural variation. Astronomers will be watching the night sky to see what happens next.
Rebecca Morell. The concept artist Sid Mead, best known for creating a dystopian Los Angeles in the film Blade Runner, has died at the age of 86. Mead, who was credited with playing a pivotal role in shaping science fiction cinema, also worked on the movies Aliens, Tron and Short Circuit. Our entertainment correspondent Colin Patterson looks back at his life.
Visual futurist. If you read the end credits of the 1982 sci-fi classic Blade Runner, that's the job listed beside the name of Sid Mead. It was a title he coined himself to describe the work he'd started to do on films. Skylines of the future, products that did not yet exist but soon would. Sid Mead created the conceptual artwork for some of the most arresting visuals in cinema history. In an interview on American Public Radio in 2011, he explained how these films often predicted impending problems in real life.
To me, science fiction is reality ahead of schedule. Points up the fact that the technology is invented and then it goes into the broad universe, and that's where it either does neat things or does horrible things.
He'd started out designing cars for the Ford Motor Company before making his name as a freelance industrial designer. His work showing a futuristic flair which attracted interest from Hollywood. Star Trek The Motion Picture was his breakthrough, creating the massive spacecraft V'ger, which threatened Earth's future. Jeff Bridges' light cycle in Tron.
I am alive.
The robots Johnny Five in Short Circuit both came from the mind of Sid Mead. Next month, he was to have received a Lifetime Achievement Award from the Art Directors Guild. Their president, Nelson Coates, has described Sid Mead as one of the most influential conceptual artists of our time.
That report by Colin Patterson. And let's end this first Global News podcast of 2020 with a look at some of the New Year celebrations that have been taking place across the world. There have been spectacular fireworks displays to welcome in the new decade, as Dan Johnson reports.
New Year, a new decade, and New Zealand kicked it off with Auckland, the first major city to welcome 2020. Sydney put on a spectacular despite calls to cancel the fireworks because of widespread bushfires. It's a global stage after all, and the show did indeed go on. A big bong and a tub-thumping soundtrack saw the start of celebrations in Japan, the first New Year's Eve of a whole new era. A across the water. Kim Jong-un's resisted too many rocket launches this year, perhaps saving North Korea's firepower for this display. And in Hong Kong, the fireworks echoed the firecrackers of protest that have reverberated through its streets.
Well, here in London, throngs of people poured into the city centre for the celebrations here. The Mayor of London said he can, said the event would be a chance for everyone to come together.
We've got more than 100,000 people watching these fireworks, millions around the world watching. And the great thing about tonight's fireworks is Big Ben's working again tonight. But also it's really important that we bring our city together again, but also our country together again as we enter the new decade.
I spoke to the newsroom's Charlotte Gallagher as she waited for those fireworks in central London.
Well, I think, Val, I'm actually in the best spot in the whole of London. Behind me is the London Eye. That's the Ferris wheel, which dominates the skyline in this part of London. And at the stroke of midnight, around 2,000 fireworks will be set off from the wheel. And then barges, which are moored on the River Thames, they've got around another 10,000 fireworks on them. So it's going to be a really spectacular show. Around 100,000 people have bought tickets to be here, and they've come from all over the world, not just here in the UK. I spoke to one man from India. He wanted to see in the new year in London. Another man, his birthday's today. He's from Alabama in the United States, and he wanted to come to London as well and see the firework display for himself, not just on TV, but in person.
So a bit of time to go. What's happening there now?
I'm going to be honest, Val, it's pretty cold. So everyone's wrapped up, drinking hot chocolate, drinking coffee, trying to keep warm. But the spirits are really high. There's a DJ playing music. And actually, would you believe, the fireworks are still being put onto the wheel. Because although this takes months and months to prepare, they only have a few hours to get the fireworks onto the big wheel. Because obviously it's running for most of the day. And they can't have people putting fireworks onto a big wheel while people are still going round. So they're still putting the finishing touches onto that. Lots of people with lights and wearing hats, festive hats. Lots of people getting very, very excited. So in the next few hours or so, that's when we'll get the big firework display. The theme this year is the Euro 2020 football matches. So they have a theme every year for the firework display. So that's this one. And so we're going to get a few football anthems, we think. Now, if you don't know English football anthems, they are a bit, some of them aren't the best, but hopefully you will enjoy them. A few Scottish and Welsh and Irish ones as well.
And have you spotted any famous footballers yet?
No famous footballers so far. I imagine they're probably in the VIP bars somewhere, aren't they, Val?
Charlotte Gallagher in central London, and I'm sure she found that VIP tent. Just time to say Happy New Year to everyone, wherever you are, from all of us here on The Newsroom. And that's it from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Valerie Sanderson. Until next time, bye-bye.
Join the millions of players around the world and bring in the new year with the all-time favorite classic match 3 game, Candy Crush Saga. It's fun to play and challenging to master, with thousands of levels to switch and match your way through. Get that sweet feeling this new year with Candy Crush Saga. Download it now from the App Store or Google Play for free.